Legal Matters.
On Legal Matters, a feature every Tuesday on this show. My name is Thabo Shole Mashao and my guest Claire Thompson, specialist family law practitioner and head of the family law department at Wits Incorporated. And we are talking about how Children's Act does not properly recognize unmarried parents who have kids through artificial insemination as compared to the unmarried, to the married ones. Claire, again, thank you so much for joining us. Happy 2023. Welcome. And it's lovely having you here.
Thank you so much. It's so lovely to be back with you again, Thabo.
Let's dispense with the legal jargon and the definitions, because I know you lawyers thrive on that. And I would like to make it as simple as possible for dropouts like myself to understand these discussions. So I'm just wondering, let's start off first with artificial insemination. And as we are talking about it, obviously that is a medical term, if you will. However, it finds itself in the legal space in this instance. And we are talking about parents who did not necessarily conceive naturally their babies, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it speaks to the ever-evolving landscape of families. And it's actually really interesting when you start delving into the various ways that families are in fact formed that are not as we traditionally understand conception to take place. And I think artificial insemination speaks to a manner in which a woman is fertilized which does not involve sexual intercourse between her and a man.
Yeah, and in that instance, Section 40 of the Children's Act does not necessarily afford parental and other rights to both unmarried parties in a permanent lifelong partnership.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, tell us about that. How did that take us a few steps back?
So I think if we look at a married couple as the sort of base point for where this conversation could start, because these are the people who afford, who are afforded parental rights and responsibilities in terms of Section 40. And before this case was heard in the High Court, the basis upon which we work is that when a couple are married and the woman is artificially inseminated, be it with her husband's sperm or with a donor sperm, the consequence of that is that both she and her husband are considered the natural parents of that child.
Okay.
And dad and mom equally acquire parental rights and responsibilities, decision-making rights. When the school gets called, for example, they get to be able to pick up, both of them get to be able to pick up the phone and say, my child should go to the doctor, for example, or my child should go to the sanatorium, or my child should be disciplined or not, or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, and in this instance, you are drawing a clear distinction between married and unmarried couples, or couples in a permanent relationship. And that's where the real issue is, right?
Yeah, so the issue comes about because if people aren't married, they don't qualify within that particular section, because the section is worded in such a way that it specifically refers to married people. And so there was a challenge that was brought to the High Court to read in the words people in a permanent life partnership into the legislation to extend that definition to include people who are not married but are still in a permanent life partnership.
And why is that important?
I think it's important because when we look at the landscape in South Africa, there are actually fewer people that are married than there are people that are living in permanent long-term cohabitation relationships. And in preparation for this discussion that I was going to have with you, I had a look at the White Paper on Families, which is such an interesting document because it speaks to how families have evolved in South Africa. And it speaks to the fact that there are fewer people who are married than are in fact living in these different sort of environments with one another, where there isn't legal recognition, but there is societal recognition. We recognize these two people as a couple. They consider one another family, even though the law doesn't.
Yes.
And what this case does is that it asks the law to catch up. And then as a result of the judgment, the legislature, the people that are responsible for making policy and for making law are also asked to come along.
Yeah, yeah. And they're asked to come along because in a practical situation, you could have a couple a man and a man, a woman and a woman, a man and a woman, whichever way. And in that instance, they do not naturally conceive a child. And they decide that they will go for artificial insemination. And one of them then won't be recognized as a parent. And that is the one who didn't contribute in the artificial insemination process. However, they are raising the child together. It could be under the same household or not, but they have agreed that they will go through this process. However, the law doesn't recognize one of them as the parent.
Yes.
That's the summary?
Absolutely it, yeah. And I think the easiest way to sort of envisage this is in a discussion about same-sex couples,
yes.
But it can equally apply to a heterosexual couple.
Sure.
But within the framework of a same-sex couple, there is inherently a need for there to be a contribution of genetic material that does not come from the other partner. And so in the case in question, two lesbians came together, wanted to create a child, wanted to have a family together, and required donor sperm. One of the women were going to carry the child and was then going to be artificially inseminated with donor sperm.
Mm.
And the intention was that both of them ultimately were going to be considered parents of this child.
Yes.
But under the alleged, they were not able to because they were not married.
Mm.
And what this case says and what the way that the law is developing is that it recognizes that not everybody chooses to get married.
Sure.
It's a choice.
Yes, 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 yes. And the law seems to make it compulsory to get married if you would want to have a family setup by omission in this particular instance.
Yes.
And now the implications are many. Claire, and one of the implications, as you've just mentioned, it could be that the child needs to get out of the country and together with one partner, and you'd feel excluded because you won't be participating in that process. But there are many other implications that would exclude you from your parental responsibilities and rights.
Absolutely. And I think what's important in all aspects that involve children is that we look at how is this child protected.
Mm.
It's, of course, there's a recognition of family, but the primary focus is always on how do we make sure that this child's rights are protected. And if we imagine a child who has past their formative years, who is now a young child or even a teenager, and that relationship is to break up.
Mm.
And there's only one parent who is the holder of parental rights and responsibilities to the exclusion of the other, even though that family setup from day one has been that both of these people, that this child considers their parents, the one person is now automatically excluded from that picture because they didn't acquire parental rights and responsibilities.
Yeah.
And what that means, what we see, at least as legal professionals, if we were to act for that person, the excluded person, the boundary or the barrier in order for them to acquire those parental rights and responsibilities is high.
Yes.
And that is, and I think, you know, we've spoken often on this segment about how the law is inaccessible to a lot of people.
Mm.
It's a common complaint that we hear. I just can't access the law. The law is just too far beyond my reach.
Yes.
And I think it's important when policy is developed, when the laws are developed, to bear that in mind, that we don't want people to have to go to the High Court in order to say, but I am the legitimate holder of parental rights and responsibilities. I've exercised these for 12, 14 years. Mm. I want to be recognized. I have been recognized up until this point, but now this relationship has come to an end and I've been left out in the cold. And now I have to come to court to ask for those when I believed inherently because of how my family was set up, that I should actually be entitled to exercise those rights.
And could it also have an adverse effect on the parent who gets to keep the child in a way that the one who's not recognized then abandons their maintenance responsibilities?
It could absolutely be that as well. And then the parent with whom the child is would then need to seek to enforce the responsibilities that other person has in order to contribute to that child's life. So there's absolutely that intersection of parental rights and parental responsibilities.
Yeah. Maybe you want to join the discussion. It could be an issue that's very close to your heart or something that you've experienced yourself. Or you've got a question to Claire and you want to ask one thing or the other, please feel at ease to do that. She's with us up until 9 o'clock, so make use of this opportunity. The number to dial, 011-883-0702, 011-883-0702. We are talking about how Children's Act does not properly recognize unmarried parents who have kids through artificial insemination compared to married parents. And as we unpack this issue, it becomes fairly pertinent as the concept of family changes and has or evolves with time. It's no longer just that typical old-fashioned family, mommy, daddy, two children, a cat, and a picket fence. It is more complex than that. You can also include in that definition a blended family situation. Let alone that, you could also include other forms of family. It's mommy and mommy, daddy and daddy, or whoever else that's right there. And so the law has not really caught up. The law is lagging behind with serious, serious implications. And as Claire has already mentioned, that one of the critical issues would be the well-being of a child. Relationships break up. Things don't always go according to plan. And what happens when these two parents go separate ways? The implications could be dire for the child. Alternatively, you can send us a text on 072-702-1702. 072-702-1702. Now, Claire, you said this went to court and it was challenged. And I understand that the court ruled in favor of the applicant in this instance. What then from now? Because now it appears that we need to climb a bridge between the court and Parliament.
So what the court says is that the words permanent life partner must be read with the word spouse. So wherever in that section we see the word spouse, you can also read in and permanent life partner.
Yes.
And so that then expands the definition of spouse to include people in permanent life partnerships. And not only does the court do that, but it also says we are giving the legislature time to debate this and create new legislation, a new policy that more adequately caters for just this business of reading in these words into this legislation to give real voice and purpose and meaning to what it is exactly that is intended by this particular section and how it is intended to protect people within the constitutional framework with children in mind so that we can protect them.
Yeah, and one of the shortfalls also, you mentioned the terminology as to when it would apply to unmarried couples. In a way where the section does not provide for the terminology as to when it would apply for unmarried couples, or a formulation to avoid denial of acquisition of parental artificial fertilization to be embarked upon by an unmarried couple. So in this instance, I'm just wondering, the law often is a bit behind. And for it to catch up with society, it would also amount to a certain amount of socialization to also bring those who will be beneficiaries of that law. And as it changes, I mean, it was only up until now, I think it was in the UK a couple of weeks ago, where the Church of England did not want to recognize same-sex marriages, did not want to anoint same-sex marriages. And I'm just wondering about the conflict in that society, and the law obviously is the umbrella and the final arbiter in this. And are there any loopholes that can be exploited by, I'm just wondering, why would the law not recognize those who are not married, who are not unmarried as spouses? However, in a normal situation, I could be having a child with someone, but I'd be held responsible whether I'm married or not to them.
I think when we look at the practicalities, for example, we were to go to children's court tomorrow, we might see there, and I'm going to again rely on traditional examples, we might see moms
yes,
in children's court claiming maintenance in the maintenance section. We might see dads in the children's court section saying, I want access to my child. I want a relationship with my child. I want to participate, and I'm not being allowed an opportunity to do so. And very often, if there is a conflict about whether or not dad is in fact entitled to exercise contact outside of the context of marriage, importantly, we need to go and rely on Section 21, which deals with the rights of unmarried fathers. And one of the aspects is the recognition of that particular man as the child's father. And very often, though it's not compulsory, very often the easiest way to deal with that for us is with a blood test to see, is dad's DNA and mom's DNA the DNA of the child, or is there another man who is in who is actually the father of the child? And this plays out very often in maintenance court, where there is a responsibility called upon that man, or in children's court, where mom is called upon to give rights to dad when dad wants a responsibility. And so when we look at a blood test or the factors that are involved in Section 21, contribution to the child's upbringing, contribution to the child's maintenance, living with mom in a permanent life partnership when the child is conceived or born, these are the sort of factors that Section 21 tells us about, but it doesn't tell us anything about two unmarried moms, for example. And naturally, after this child is born, the DNA of both moms is not going to be present. And so what do we do?
Oh, my goodness.
Does that mean that I'm going to say the second mom, not to create any sort of distinction between the two of them, but the mom that did not contribute genetically to that child, are we saying that she now needs to adopt that child in order to hold parental rights and responsibilities, which again is a cumbersome legal process? Does she need to approach the court and ask for the granting of parental rights and responsibilities? All of these things are so difficult. And what we really want is that from the date of that child's birth, that both of those moms' names appear on that child's birth certificate from the get-go to say, these are these this child's parents.
I see, because I was just about to ask, how do you establish consent of parenthood, especially if they're not married? Is it contractual? When IVF is considered, should both partners write down that we are going for this process? And I'm saying that playing devil's advocate in many ways, knowing how a number of men abandon their children. And in this instance, someone may feel that this relationship is broken. I'd rather break ties with all of them and say, this was not my idea anyway. I was not part of this. It's her own issues. She'll deal with it, or he'll deal with it. It's his own issues. So how do you establish that initial consent at the very beginning?
I think that's a very valid question. And I think perhaps it would be... if I was to be advising a doctor, for example, a fertility specialist, I would say it would be worth seeking the consent of both people and at least having confirmation that they agree that they are in life partnership with one another. And when we look at the case, the court observes what leads us to the conclusion that these two women are, in fact, in a permanent life partnership. And it's things like they consider each other family, their friends, their extended family look at this couple and say, yes, they are indeed a couple. And that's how they are outwardly demonstrative of their relationship in public. But if I was to be advising, you know, typical lawyer, I'll say that I would want a document where at least I got consent from both parties.
Yeah, because that becomes very important, given that the DNA is excluded from the arrangement, and therefore the responsibility has to be determined. That yes, it doesn't suit you now, but this is your child. As per consent, right from the beginning. 011-883-0702, 011-883-0702. Alternatively, 072-702-1071. 1702. This one says, hello, I'm planning to have insemination next month or IVF, but now you said it's against the law, so is IVF also not allowed? In vitro fertilization. No, I didn't say that. We didn't say that. That's not what we said at all. Do you want to clarify that, Claire, once again?
Yeah, definitely not. IVF is definitely 100% in terms of the law. Artificial insemination is absolutely in terms of the law. And I want to say congratulations and good luck.
Yes, indeed, indeed.
Very exciting.
Yeah. But I think then, in this instance, would this person be a beneficiary of the court's outcome?
So I would need a little bit more information.
Sure,
but
from
let's
them.
Assume, let's assume that the person is a single woman,
yeah,
who's being artificially inseminated or going through IVF by herself.
Mm.
She automatically acquires parental rights and responsibilities as mom.
Mm.
No questions asked from the get-go. She's the person who's registered on the birth certificate. If she is in a permanent life partnership with a man and his DNA is going to be used, both of them automatically acquire parental rights and responsibilities. And artificial insemination in instances like that may take place by way of example because a couple is HIV positive and they can't have unprotected sex, but they can still conceive a child through the wonders of modern medicine.
Yes.
And so they can have a baby with artificial insemination using the genetic material that fertility clinics, are able to do what they can do in order to ensure that that is safe for the child that's going to be born.
Sure.
If it is that they are in a permanent life partnership and they're not going to use dad's genetic material, then this case is going to be applicable for them. If she is a woman in a same-sex relationship, this judgment is also going to be applicable for her.
We spoke about the law lagging a little bit behind, and I'm just wondering, the instruments of the law, are they also a bit behind and archaic, and they need to evolve together with the law? And by that, I mean, in this instance, the question of a birth certificate, where it then mentions, as far as I know, I could be wrong, father and mother. And that particular wedding, should it also be considered if we are then to say that you will have same-sex marriages, and let alone marriages, but partnerships in this instance, where a mother would have to then say that I am a parent. Should it just say parents as opposed to mother and father?
That certainly would be the gender-neutral response,
yeah.
I think. I must actually go and look and see whether I've got any birth certificates in any of my files, in which I don't know. I mean, it's such an interesting question that you pose, and I think we just take it for granted.
Yes.
Like parent one, parent two,
yes.
You don't even think about it. I think actually it's so interesting that you mention this point, because I actually think that people might have difficulties in the face of this judgment with Home Affairs.
Mm.
With Home Affairs officials who, even with the best intentions in the world, might not have heard of this judgment.
Yeah.
And in which case, an application would have to be brought to court to compel Home Affairs. And so if there are any Home Affairs officials listening, I hope that I can at least assure them that this judgment means that it expands that wording of spouse to also include same-sex couples or heterosexual couples who are in permanent life partnerships to include on a birth certificate for a child.
Yeah, and perhaps gender-neutral terminology on the birth certificate that could just say parent one, parent two, because also you'd be infringing on someone's rights and identity if they don't necessarily identify as a father or as a mother under such circumstances. And now a Home Affairs official will say, I have to put you somewhere. If you have to be registered, I have to put you somewhere. And what do we do under such circumstances? It's not going to be that easy. By the way, the person who sent us that earlier message went on to mention later on that we are not married. So clearly it's applicable.
Mm, and it'll depend again on whose genetic material is in fact going to be used. Is there a donor sperm going to be used?
Mm.
Or is it dad's? Or if there is a dad, even a male?
Yes.
In the process.
Yes. We have another question on 072-702-1702. 072-702-1702. You can also leave a voice note, by the way, on the very same number. Alternatively, give us a call if you don't mind on 011-883-0702. Alternatively, 021-446-0567. Can unmarried individuals draw their own contract or plan their or their planned their planned artificial insemination?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I can't see why not. I think an agreement is what an agreement is. And I think very often, you know, there's this mystery that's created around contract that somehow it's imbibed with validity because an attorney is involved, which in fact is not the case. You and I can write on a serviette today, I agree to X and you agree to Y. And Bob's your uncle, we have a valid and binding contract.
And it's as simple as that. I mean, or alternatively, an affidavit. I'm just wondering, perhaps shouldn't the law come to create a form of sorts that would make it a bit easier? And I'm also saying that considering the landscape of our country, where it could happen in the rural areas or somewhere in the remote areas, and or just around here, wherever we are right now in the urban South Africa, where people are not necessarily au fait with that, or they don't know how to do it altogether with the good intentions.
Yeah, you know, I really hope that my time here at least creates a little bit of a demystification of what the legal process is. That's really my intention when I come here. And I think it's really important whenever I speak to people, I want to try and take away this mystery that is in fact the law. Yeah. And I think, you know, under certain circumstances, if you're entering into a shareholders agreement, maybe you need an attorney. Mm. But I will say, you know, if you and your partner get together and, you know, like, you're like, okay, what do we agree on? I agree that I'm going to be responsible for 50% of the groceries and you're going to be responsible for 50% of the groceries. I'm going to pay for our medical aid and you're going to pay another 2,000 rand towards the bond.
Yeah.
Both of us are going to pay the dog bills or whatever the case may be. You know, even if it's that simple and you put it down in an agreement and you sign it, there are certain things that are not going to be binding. For example, like, it is our philosophy that we are going to raise our child as a vegetarian.
Yes.
It might not be that we can go to court on that document and say if the other person has fed the child a little bit of biltong, that the wrath of the law is going to fall down upon them. But I think in the context of that document, there will be things that if attorneys need to, or even the court officials or the magistrate's court, they can extract an intention that exists between those parties as to what their obligations to one another were. And that's what a contract is.
Fantastic. 011-883-0702. Let's go to Cyril in Midrand. I suspect it's not the Cyril that is responsible for the country. Cyril, you there?
No, definitely not.
Not my lucky day, clearly. I'm just joking. Cyril, welcome. What's on your mind?
All right. I just wanted to ask a question regarding the legalities when you mentioned the participating DNA parent.
Yes.
In a situation where the couple is not married, boyfriend, girlfriend, but they conceive through artificial insemination, the girlfriend uses a donor egg and the boyfriend uses his own sperm, does the mother automatically acquire the parental right? I'm assuming the DNA of the father, obviously, that also assumes an automatic right.
Fantastic. I'm just going to throw it to Claire. Claire?
Such an interesting question. And I think, you know, there's this presumption in law that the child that is born of the mother is the child's mother.
Yes.
If that makes sense. That being said, I think this case allows us the latitude, at least, to ensure that we are protected. And I think that's what's important, is that prior to this judgment, that is certainly a question that could have been asked. But as a result of this case, what we see is this expansion of the definition of spouse to include permanent life partner. And so mom's parental rights and responsibilities as a result of this case are in fact assured.
Mm. Cyril, does it clear your mind, or you've got a follow-up question?
No, it does clear my mind. Thank you.
Okay, really appreciate your call. All the best. 011-883-0702. 011-883-0702. And at Cape Talk Studios, 021-446-0567. 021-446-0567. I see a question here as well. And... can unmarried individuals draw their own... Oh, yeah, that's the one that I've asked just now. And I'm not sure about the subsequent question if it relates to this. But nonetheless, let's try. You'll tell us, Claire, if it's not relevant to our discussion. If a woman steals a man's sperm, e.g. From a used protection, and then inseminates herself with it, can the man later be forced to pay maintenance or held accountable for the baby?
Sure, that's a big question. Though I will say, not the first time I've heard this as a question. I think the man in this case bears a burden of proof. Mm-hmm. And I think he bears quite a steep one because of the reasonable plausibility that a condom could fail. It's not a foolproof method, as no... contraception is at all.
Yes, yes.
And we all know that babies have been born even when people have used contraception of many different types. Yeah. I think the question ultimately needs to be asked, why is this question being asked? Perhaps it is that this person didn't want to become a father, had no intention of raising a child of their own. And I think what we need to bear in mind as a society is that this is a fair proposition. Some people just don't want to be parents. Mm. And the responsibility on that father to parent that child is not absolute. Mm. There is no absolute requirement in law that just because you are the biological father of a child, that you are compelled to have a relationship with that child, to care for that child, to have contact with that child, even though that's something that I think very often we desire as a society. That's not a requirement. Where there might be an obligation that is created is in terms of maintenance. Mm-hmm. Because Section 21 of the Act says that dad may not fulfill the criteria to acquire parental rights and responsibilities. However, he still acquires the obligation to pay maintenance.
And the burden in this instance is insurmountable. It's almost impossible. I don't know how.
How does one prove this?
Yeah. It would be extremely difficult.
Very, very difficult to prove.
Yeah. 011-883-0702, 011-883-0702. Alternatively, on Twitter, the handle of the station, @Radio702. And my handle is @IamFreeTSM. And my guest, Claire Thompson, a legal expert, and we are chatting about artificial insemination, why the rights of unmarried parents who go through artificial insemination are somehow not recognized as the rights of married parents. And our circumstances are different. The family definition has evolved with time. It used to be mom, dad, kids, a dog, a fence, but it's far more than that now. And why is the law lagging behind? And the ramifications are truly dire, particularly for a child. We're talking about maintenance. We're talking about other forms of responsibility, birth certificate, identity of the child also is a big thing in South Africa, Claire. And, you know, a whole lot of South Africans, even at a later stage, they would want to identify with one parent or the other. And this can also play a role in that. It could be the issues, the cultural matters that come into question in a typical South African fashion, that the other parent subscribe to a certain cultural belief and the other doesn't. And how do you then say, this is my child as well, I want us to have a ceremony for them, and we are part with the partner, and I want them to go through a rite of passage as per my clan, And the other partner says, oh no, it's not going to go down that way. So it's very murky.
And these are such important issues in South Africa. Mm. And I think these are questions that the Children's Court is often tasked to adjudicate between partners or spouses even, because I think this shows up in marriages just as much as it does in relationships. Mm. It might be that the marriage relationship provides us with more guidance as to the fact that the child is of the husband's family, for example. Mm. But it nevertheless creates the question when there is a relationship between partners. Whose family culture does the child follow? Mm. Have damages been paid, for example?
Yes.
If they haven't been paid, is there a reason why?
Mm.
Whose family is going to take responsibility for these aspects of the child? And again, if we look at the child's best interests, how is that going to impact the child? Because sometimes much later on in life, when questions of people having their own children, these questions are raised when people introspect. And when I had the privilege of sitting as a magistrate, these were some of the questions that came before me.
Mm.
And these were the stories that I was privileged to listen to.
And it must have been very difficult, because it's not as clear as day to navigate all those difficult issues, culture, intersection with the law, intersection with other social issues that can be problematic. But Claire, was this the first case? I'm surprised. I thought we would have seen many cases in various courts that would have challenged this definition. Was it the first one?
So this is the first one that I've come about.
Okay.
It's entirely possible that
sure.
There have been similar cases heard, but I think the fact that this matter has referred this back to the legislature to reconsider the legislation is a good indicator that this is specific of its particular type.
Mm.
But I think when we consider where we are as a country, and I think you mentioned in reflection to the UK, for example.
Yes.
I think we must appreciate and recognize in South Africa how progressive our legislation very often
definitely.
Is. And I think it's an incredible privilege to live in a country with legislation that really considers and digs into this question of who really is a family in South Africa, and how has family evolved from when the Children's Act was drafted in 2005 to where we are in 2023.
Mm.
And recognizing that even in that short space of time, because when we look at how long legislation has been around for in South Africa, we can go back many, many years.
Yeah, and you're saying that, and I'm just thinking of what's happening in the USA right now as regards to termination of pregnancy. And one would have thought that this is the capital of democracy in the world, and legislation on such issues would be far advanced than us. But it looks as if they are back at 1982, particularly in some states where the Supreme Court then is not as liberal in its outcomes as we thought it would be, angering a lot of women rights issue, human, not just women, but also human rights activists, who are concerned that why is it that termination of pregnancy cannot be recognized, obviously considering time and all those things. And us as South Africa, we are very much ahead, as much as we may be a developmental state.
I think, and sometimes that's a misnomer. I think sometimes we sell each ourselves a bit short.
Yeah.
And I think the issue of termination of pregnancy is inevitably very polarizing. People have very strong opinions one way or another. But I think what is so fantastic about the South African legislation is that it affords women the opportunity of choice.
Yeah.
And that is what we really, really seek. And what better way to self-actualize and self-realize but through choice, where you can choose to have an artificial insemination process. As a single woman, you can choose to become a father as a single man through surrogacy. Mm. You can choose to terminate your pregnancy. Whether you are not ready to have a child, or you never wanted to be a parent, or whether you've had too many children and it's too big a strain on your family and all of the other children in your household. All of these represent real choices that we have in South Africa. And there is so much that we have to be thankful for in that regard, I think.
From now on, we have a minute to go. And I'm just thinking, perhaps there are people who are just thinking this came at a right time, at a perfect time. And because of the ruling of the court, does it mean that it's in effect already?
Yes, as a result of this particular judgment, immediately that additional and people in permanent life partnerships is automatically read into that legislation, even though the legislature is given time to develop the law. That'll come in time.
Yes.
Right now, it affords people real protection and responsibility right now.
And those are some great news. It says that we are progressive as a country and we are moving forward. Claire, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. All the best. How do people reach you?
Thank you so much for having me. People are welcome to contact us on our landline on 011-010-0400, or you can have a look at our website at www.witsinc.co.za.
And this was Legal Matters, and our guest, Claire Thompson, specialist family law practitioner and head of the family law department at Wits Incorporated.